I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. This is Fronteras, a show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Jennifer Tiga was born in 1970 to a white German mother and a black Nigerian father. Her mother left her in the care of an orphanage as an infant. Tiga was taken in by a German foster family at age 3. And until her formal adoption by the same family at age 7, she still had sporadic contact with her birth mother and grandmother. As an adult, in her late 30s, Tiga made the surprising discovery that she was the granddaughter of a Nazi, specifically the sadistic Amon Göth, whose horrific crimes against Jews were detailed in the 1993 Steven Spielberg film Schindler's List. Göth was the commandant of the Krakow-Plaszow concentration camp in Poland. He and Tiga's grandmother lived together in a villa near the camp. Tiga wrote about her struggles coming to terms with her family history in the book My Grandfather Would Have Shot Me, A Black Woman Discovers Her Family's Nazi Past. Tiga was in San Antonio in March for a fundraiser for the city's Holocaust Memorial Museum. She had a chance to sit down with us to talk about the day she made that life-changing discovery.
It was an ordinary day. It was a sunny day a couple of years ago when I, in the morning, went to the Central Library. It is a big library in my hometown. I live in Germany, in Hamburg. I saw a book on the shelf, and it had a red cover. The title was I Have to Love My Father, Don't I? So I picked the book from the shelf, and I quickly glanced at the cover. The subtitle said, Monika Göth, daughter of the concentration camp commandant from Schindler's List. And there was one picture of a woman that reminded me of my biological mother. And there was another picture that reminded me of my biological grandmother. At the very end, there was a summarization of biographical details. And these details perfectly matched the information that I had surrounding my adoption paperwork. And at that moment, I realized that the book that I was holding in my hands was not just a random book. It was a book that told the story of my biological family and of my biological grandfather.
Now, going back a little bit, you were adopted at a young age, but when you were still quite little, you still had that relationship with your biological mother and your biological grandmother, which is why you had that sense of recognition. But obviously, being so young, you never really were told about your background at the time. And when you were adopted by your family also did not know any information about your background. So I'm assuming it was an absolute shock and almost disbelief that came over you.
Absolutely. I had some limited knowledge of my biological family's past. I came to an orphanage when I was 3 weeks old, but I saw my mother sporadically for the first 7 years. I also saw my biological grandmother. And once I was adopted by a foster family that took me from the orphanage and I lived with that family, I would not see my mother nor my grandmother. So there was, for many years, no contact, no information, just many questions. And when I was in the library and I suddenly found a book that gave me so many answers, that was a shock by itself. So I always say it was a twofold shock. First of all, to find a book about my biological mother, who I missed and have seen for so many years. But then the second shock, to find out who my biological grandfather was, that was really difficult.
And I don't know if it was just coincidence, but you said that after you had made that discovery in the library, just not that long afterwards, there was a documentary that aired with your mother talking about her experiences in being Amon Göth's daughter.
That was so surreal, because imagine. And what I did after I finished reading the book cover to cover, I did research on the internet because I wanted to verify everything that was written in the book was reality, or maybe that was just fiction. I didn't know. While I did the research, I made the discovery that there was a movie shown on German TV. It was shown for the very first time just hours after I came from the library. The movie is Inheritance. And in that movie, my biological mother, Monica, meets with the survivor. The survivor's name is Helen Rosenzweig, and those who watched the movie Schindler's List know her because she was the maid who lived in the household of Amon Göth. The situation itself is difficult, but you can also, when you see Helen back, they meet in the villa where Helen lived for all these years next to the concentration camp, you can still see the fear in her eyes. But what was also, for me at least, interesting was I would see my mother after all these years. I haven't seen her since I was 7 years old. This was the last time that we had contact. So more than 30 years had passed. And I saw my mother for the very, very first time again in that documentary. Yeah, it was actually, it was not a twofold shock. It was a threefold shock on that day.
And I understand that you, once you made that discovery, it really sucked you in and it dominated pretty much your whole life. And you sank into a very deep depression afterwards. And I understand you also had a bit of a history of depression when you were younger as well.
Absolutely. It started in, I would say, in the beginning of my 20s. I think the depression was due to the early deprivation, probably being given up as a child at such an early age is always a burden for every child, but also the toxic power of the family secret that was kept from me. And in the very beginning, I felt a lot of fear. Those who watched the movie Schindler's List, they probably remember how sadistic the personality of Amon Göth is or was. So I ask myself if I carry something of that man within me. And I remember there was a moment when I was in my bathroom, standing in front of a mirror, and I watched at a photograph. It was a photograph of Amon Göth. And at the same time, I looked at myself at the mirror, and I saw some similarities, some features in our face. And it was so scary, so, so scary. Of course, you know, those feelings are irrational feelings. But at that moment, I was still so confused that I was simply scared. And today I want to let you all know that, of course, there is no Nazi gene. But that took really a long time to come to that conclusion.
And that is something that you write in your book about this so-called Nazi gene that many descendants of Nazis might feel, the first generation, especially the sons, the daughters, that they have this overpowering sense of history on their head, that it envelops their entire lives. Like you wrote about your mother, the times when you would meet with her after you made the discovery and you reached out and you were able to connect again, that was about all that she could talk about.
My mother is the second generation that still is educated, first of all, by the first generation. And also the identification with your own parents is very strong. So a lot of these descendants were never able to develop an identity apart from knowing to which family they belonged. And that was difficult. In my specific case now, and it was a bit different because I had so many years without knowing, so I was able to develop an identity apart from being the granddaughter of a Nazi concentration camp commandant. In a way, it makes it easier. I truly believe that one does not inherit guilt. What you inherit is responsibility. Responsibility as a human being to care for the next one, but also in my case, responsibility simply because I'm German and also because I'm the granddaughter of a Nazi concentration camp commandant.
So when you were a child, and this was when you were still in foster care with the family that would eventually adopt you, you did spend some time with your mother and your grandmother, but you felt you connected more with your grandmother emotionally. And when you made the discovery that she was Amon Göth's lover, you have these intense feelings of conflict. Mm-hmm. And do I still love my grandmother for the woman that I knew, or do I need to repel that part of her that I didn't?
Well, with my mother, I always had, I would say, from the very beginning, a quite difficult situation that is also due to the fact that my biological parents, my father's Nigerian, broke up before I was born. So we got along, but it wasn't an easy relationship from the very beginning. She sometimes said I reminded her of my father. With my grandmother, it was different. She wasn't the grandmother that would play with me at the playground, getting dirty on her knees. No, she was a sort of a lady, and we had more an adult relationship. But she was very kind to me, and she never had a grudge against me, for example, because of the color of my skin. And I had good memories of her. And I saw her last when I was 7 years old. She committed suicide when I was 12. I knew about that she passed away, but I didn't know the specific reason at that time. So for all these years, she was somehow lost. And then I found her again, but I found her through the book that was written about the family. So I saw her in a different light, and I understood that she was somehow a woman with two faces. On the one hand, she was the woman that I have loving memories of. And on the other side, she was a woman who was capable of living with a man as sadistic as Amon Göth next to a concentration camp. And to bring together these two aspects of her personality was almost impossible. I didn't know how to deal with it. And I felt still that feeling of love. It was a feeling like the feeling of a child, and I didn't know where to place these feelings. But today I say it's important to admit to both feelings. She left a suicide note, actually, and that would have been a good opportunity to say I'm sorry or to admit to her role during the war, but she did not. My grandmother was, differently to Amon Göth, not convicted after the war. Amon Göth was hanged, and my grandmother was, in the legal sense at least, she wasn't guilty. There was no trial, nothing. But I do think it's so important to emphasize that she was guilty, and she somehow represents the majority of people who supported the system. And that's important because those are the danger that we are facing again nowadays.
Well, you and I are about the same age. My father was a World War II vet, and you have this connection to Nazi Germany. But with each successive generation, more and more people who lived in that era, the soldiers, the Jews who survived the Holocaust, they are quickly disappearing. They're dying off. So do you feel almost like it's important, that you feel it's kind of a purpose for you to reach out and say, this is still a piece of history that needs to be kept alive? Why do you think it's important to be able to share that information with the public and not maybe keep it to yourself or to a close circle of friends or family?
Well, I do believe in the art of storytelling. I think that a story sometimes can transport or transmit information that needs to be known. In the case of the victim side, if you talk about 7 million Jews, it's difficult to grasp. If you hear the story from a survivor, it's more easy somehow to feel it and to learn from it. Some of the patterns, unfortunately, are not new. Like when we talk about the Holocaust, we have Holocaust education that is, first of all, there to honor the victims, to remember the victims, so that people won't forget. I do more focus in my work is to have a bridge between the past, the present, and the future, to make people understand that what happened in the past is something that can happen again. And it's the same pattern. We still fight with the same issues, you know, hatred or prejudice or minorities all over the world now facing discrimination, for example. So what I try to show people is that the Holocaust or what happened during the Holocaust is something that will probably not happen again in the exact same way, but the danger is still there that history might repeat itself. And I don't often talk about politics, but I do think one needs to talk about politics nowadays, because if I look at the world and I see the rise of populist leaders all over the world, in the United States, in Europe, even in Germany, we have a right-wing party again now in parliament that is very scary and very frightening, so one needs to speak out.
Jennifer Tiga is the author of My Grandfather Would Have Shot Me, A Black Woman Discovers Her Family's Nazi Past. To hear more of my interview, go to tpr.org. When we come back, the revival of an impoverished San Antonio neighborhood.
We're living in a new generation, and we're going to have to entertain our younger people. You know, we've got to have a place for them to go.
How San Antonio's East Side is experiencing a reawakening. Coming up next on Fronteras. Stay with us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Welcome back to Fronteras. East Side San Antonio is one of the city's oldest and most distressed neighborhoods. Unemployment rates in the East Side hover around 10%, which is far above the citywide average of around 3%. The East Side, which consists of approximately 22 square miles, has a poverty rate of 33%, and 30% of residents over age 25 do not have a high school diploma. But economic development is revitalizing East Side neighborhoods. In 2014, President Barack Obama declared San Antonio's East Side a Promise Zone, an initiative aimed at revitalizing high-poverty neighborhoods with job creation, economic activity, and crime reduction. A four-mile area inside that Promise Zone is being revitalized through a $29.7 million Choice Neighborhood Grant from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. The San Antonio Housing Authority is managing the grant. Here's Maribel Resendiz, communications manager with SAHA.
In comparison to the city, this area had like high levels of crime, and it did not have the amenities that, you know, some other areas or zip codes in the city have. So when it came to the type of amenities and services, this part of the city really lacked that access. So when we received the grant, it was to transform this community so that we could bring what the other areas of the city have to this community.
It's breathtaking to see gleaming, newly constructed apartments in a still distressed part of town. It's a far cry from the public housing which once stood in its footprint. The Wheatley Courts public housing complex is history. No more cinder block walls, grassless lots, or lack of air conditioning. It's been replaced by the East Meadows mixed income family units and by a senior center known as Wheatley Park Senior Living. It's one thing to have a nice place to live, but life isn't just lived behind four walls. What's there to do outside? SAHA is teaming with a Texas artist, a local landscaping company, and local architects to further revitalize a narrow one-acre strip of land across the street from the East Meadows Apartments and Wheatley Park Senior Living. Here again is Resendiz.
We wanted the community to see how what they had wasn't what they were going to have forever. So when we're building these mixed-income communities, it was with community input, and they told us how they wanted their community to look. So now when they see what we're building, that's something that they're proud of, and it shows like this is what this community should have been.
A relatively new sidewalk winds its way around the rectangular, weedy site of the future Phyllis Wheatley Park. Trees have also recently been planted in the parkway between the sidewalk and the street. The park will honor two prominent African-American figures in the arts, Phyllis Wheatley, a former slave born around 1753 in West Africa, who became the first African-American woman to publish a book of poetry in the U.S. The park will also honor Ira Aldridge, a 19th century black actor and playwright who was the first African-American actor to establish himself professionally in Europe. The arts, appropriately, are playing a role in the future design of this park. At a recent community meeting in the new Wheatley Park Senior Living Center, Houston artist Reginald Charles Adams says he's looking forward to hearing what community members want in their park space.
My vision is pretty open and clear because I really want to start with the feedback that we're going to hear tonight from the community members and allow them to really influence the vision of what we may bring artistically to this particular site.
Adam says community involvement is vital in instilling pride in the final product.
Those kinds of projects speak to a different approach in community-based art, where it's not just an artist coming in and saying, hey, here's my idea, take it or leave it, love it or hate it, but a more thoughtful approach where entities such as the San Antonio Housing Authority are looking at, if we're going to spend these tax dollars, if we're going to spend public money, how can we spend it in such a way where the public is actually a part of that creative process?
Eastsider Tyrena Wynn is one of Wheatley Park Senior Living Center's newest residents. She says she hopes the park has something for the people living at the center.
Probably a bunch of activities in the park to get the people out. Music, and then you talk about art. We definitely love art. I'd love to see a graffiti wall or something like that.
East Sider Pamela Bishop, another new resident of the Senior Center, also has hopes for a small space for the area's older citizens.
We can't sit up there and compete with all these young people. We want a gazebo, a little garden, you know, with butterflies and, you know, stuff like that, and a little water wall. And we can sit there in comfort and enjoy ourselves, you know, because we're right here across the street. And then we've been trying to get a smoking area, too, because we can't smoke over here. A little small one wouldn't help hurt us. You know, we can't burn up the park.
Irma Harris-Tate, another East Side resident, says planners also have to think about making a space in the park for the neighborhood's young people.
We're living in a new generation, and we're going to have to entertain our younger people. You know, we've got to have a place for them to go. If they're going to just hang on the street, you know, and get angry, depressed. But if they have a place where they can go with art, let them know that the world is round. You know what I'm saying?
Input is still being gathered by the community for the new park. Design reviews are planned for July, and the final reveal will come in spring 2019. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Norma Martinez produced the broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.